stripped me dry. There was so much water, I couldn't believe my eyes. And I was worried about my family. Will they be alright? Will they make it on the I-2 for another night?
Many nations around the world have incorporated human rights provisions into their legal framework and now provide more basic rights to their people than the United States. In key instances, international human rights standards are broader and more protective than the U.S. Constitution or domestic civil rights laws. At this moment in history, the notion of applying a universal human rights framework to the United States seems to be striking a chord with activists around the country.
What do we want?
Human rights!
Where do we want it?
Now!
This is Ajamu Baraka, Executive Director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and you're listening to No Retreat, No Retreat, Compromise,
No Compromise, No Compromise.
The United Nations Durban Review Conference took place last week from April 20th to the 24th in Geneva, Switzerland. It was a follow-up to the 2001 World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa. The goal of the conference was to evaluate the progress countries have made in implementing the 2001 Durban Declaration and Program of Action, which addresses racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and other related intolerances. The United States, Canada, Israel, and a number of European countries boycotted the global conference. The Obama administration objected to language in the draft outcome document during the preparatory meetings. In response, the UN Working Group removed language critical of Israel's occupation of historic Palestine, references to the defamation of religion, and reparations for slavery and the transatlantic slave trade. Although the language the U.S. objected to was removed before the conference, the administration maintained its boycott. The U.S. mainly opposed the outcome document reaffirming the 2001 Durban Declaration and Program of Action. On the first day, criticism of the review process heightened after Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, president of Iran, made comments about Israel in his speech. In a planned action, a group of participants protested, disrupting the proceedings, and a number of European delegates walked out. The outcome document was scheduled to be adopted at the end of the conference, but was adopted by consensus the next day. Despite the interruption and negative press, Navi Pillay, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, hailed the conference a success and congratulated all the governments who stayed on coming to a consensus. Many anti-racism organizations from around the world, including the U.S., took part in the gathering. In this episode, we bring you the voices of civil society who participated in the review conference.
I'm Marianela Carvajal from Dominican Republic. I'm from the Black Women's Forum of Dominican Republic.
Patrick Watkins, Global Campaign for Education.
Masood Shajere, I'm the chair of Islamic Human Rights Commission based in London.
I'm Sakaya Thomas, I'm with the Global African Congress.
My name is Beatrice Schultes, I'm an indigenous woman.
Okay. My name is Jonas Andreas, I'm from the African Council in Berlin.
It's the Indigenous Peoples and Nations Coalition from Alaska, so Ambassador Ronald Barnes.
My name is Humberto Brown, I'm Panamanian, I reside in the United States and work with a network of Afro-Latinos and Caribbean organization.
Paul Divakar, National Campaign on Dalit Human Rights, India.
See, caste-based discrimination has been very old, but despite many attempts, the United Nations and many of its organs have not sufficiently included it, especially the Durban conference in Durban 1, just about tried, but the official conference did not, but the wider civil society and later the CERD, the Committee for Elimination of Racial Discrimination, have recognized it. But what we're disappointed is the 8 years past the Durban Review Conference, now that is coming in, has absolutely taken any reference to caste-based discrimination away. And we're extremely disappointed and we are protesting against that.
The situation for Africans, for example, in Germany has totally deteriorated. The Africans being killed by racists and being attacked has increased, is increasing year by year. So we would have liked the German government to come here and we should have told them exactly, or representatives of other European countries, but unfortunately they decided to stay away. because they produced a paper, a national action plan against racism, where there is no action in it, there is no plan in it. It's a paper which is made up of all programs against right-wing extremisms, which has nothing to do with the issue, and they don't address the issue of African and African descent in no sentence at all.
We are deeply disappointed in the U.S. government for its decision not to participate once again in this very important process and for leading the way in the boycott of this conference by other member states. We also regret the manner in which several governments and NGOs chose to conduct themselves during the first day of this conference and the expediency in which the document was passed without the full participation of civil society. U.S. civil society is present at this forum to support proposals coming out of the global Afro-descendant NGOs and all those that are here to struggle for liberation. But we are also here to remind member states that the vestiges of racial discrimination in the United States continues to create a racialized society where one in three black men is under surveillance of the criminal justice system, where a majority of African Americans displaced by Hurricane Katrina and Rita have yet to return home and are internally displaced within the United States, and where black and Latino women make up 81% of people living with HIV and AIDS. It is clear that we cannot claim that we are in a post-racial era in the United States, but in fact, race is a determinant of poverty and marginalization within the U.S. We urge governments, including our own, in this time of economic crisis, to ensure that the economic stimulus packages pay particular attention to the economic marginalization of racial minorities and women. I once again regret that our government, with a legacy of abhorrent racism and colonialism, and with obligations under the International Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, have decided to ignore important issues of racism within its borders, particularly after promises of a new era of international engagement and diplomacy. The U.S. Human Rights Network and member NGOs call for a Durban Plus 10 and will continue to push for the U.S. government to participate in future convenings on this issue and will continue to engage with the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination by submitting shadow reports and progress related to the Durban Plan of Action. Thank you.
Of course, everyone knows that the president of Iran was here and he made some very direct statements. My response to the EU walkout is the EU walkout itself. They should have stayed in the room. At least the president of Iran is very direct and upfront with his concerns. They don't like it. On the other side of the coin, as I mentioned, it was the EU states who blocked the attempt to address colonialism based on grounds of racial discrimination, which is a crime against humanity. They speak from both sides of their mouths. If they were to get up and say, we deny you racial, we deny that you can address this, and we are superior, because I sent a document to every one of the EU states through the EU coordinator, the Czech Republic, saying that why did you block this, that this is a crime against humanity, and you continue to block it. Ironically, it was Iran who reinstated the document after Africa put it in. It was taken out by the EU, and the EU again blocked it. So the EU would look the other way when crimes against humanity are being committed, and then they would point a finger at Iran for saying that Zionism is racism. Who are they to point fingers?
This conference about racism, about former colonial countries, is still a major issue for the European countries, because the question of their responsibility of the condition in many countries is linked directly to the legacy of colonialism and those systems of racial exclusion as apartheid or Jim Crow that existed prior. It's also that the center issue of the conflict between the Israeli government and the treatment of the Palestinian people is in the lap of the Second World War and the atrocity of the Holocaust that they are responsible for, and not the Palestinian and other people. So this conference is dealing with two areas that are still relevant for how these countries are rules, control, and the way resources and power is exercised in most of the country. So it's not just an environmental conference, a side topic. This conference is about the essence of new democracy and the voices of people who for too long has been excluded from society to call themselves democracy. And we don't believe that you can have racist democracy. Either you are democracy or you're not democracies.
The challenges were related to the general opposition from some powerful countries against the very holding of the Durban Review Conference, those who did not want to reaffirm the Durban agreements. So we found ourselves in a situation where even the UN Secretariat were not favorable to the normal kind of NGO preparations and supporting activities for this Durban Review Conference, and that related also to the holding of a civil society forum. Civil society forums, NGO forums, has been held in connection with every important UN conference since 1972 at the first Stockholm Conference on Environment. And we felt as responsible NGOs and anti-racist activists that we had to do our role and organize a civil society forum as a catalyst for further NGO actions and preparations for this official conference. And we are glad that we were successful to do it. We did it independently. We had hardly any support from any major sources, but we got together. What we have said is that we need a Durban plus 10 process. That means that we will come back and do all the reviewing of what is done and what needs to be done in implementing the Durban Declaration from 2 years after this. So this is really a main decision that we have taken as NGOs. We ask governments to do the same, because this conference is not really fulfilling the needs for a reasonable and full review of the Durban implementation.
I think this week was not what I was expecting. Civil society, since the very beginning, we were with no information of what is next. The document got approved immediately, got approved with this pretty weak points and strong points, and civil society is trying to in the middle of the development of that, of this review, is redefining the strategy, because some people knew that it might happen, but we were not that ready for that, and we were scared that as it happens that the Palestinian and Israeli issue might take over the spirit of the Durban review conference, and for instance the sexual diversities and needs are not in the center of Durban, the xenophobia is not in the center of Durban, and the racism itself is not in the center of Durban, because the issue of Palestine and Israel has taken over all that, and a civil society is in this moment has not been strong enough to put it back in the center.
That there has been no effective voice among the organizations who were not able to participate in the earlier stages of the preparatory work, who only had the resources to get here these last few days. Those voices, the less privileged voices, have been effectively excluded. And what we see here these last few days is a reduction in the ability of civil society to participate in these UN processes. In the 1990s, there was a real commitment, it appeared, on the part of the UN to ensure that the people's voices were heard. But as a consequence of the power of those gatherings, it appears that some decisions have been made to basically sideline the people's voices once again.
On the level of participation of NGOs, points of entry in terms of participation, contributions, review process was very, very, very limited, except for the NGOs that managed to come about 1 month before to be at the beginning of the PrepCom. It's a very watered down declaration. And even though there's a consensus on a certain number of basic issues, it doesn't add anything to the original Durban Declaration. And people are always saying, yes, but you have to think of it as a process, and we're only at the beginning. If this is the beginning, we've spent 8 years doing nothing since 2001. So it's very disappointing. And in terms of reviewing what happened between 2001 and 2008, implementation, I haven't heard anything very, very thoughtful and wide-ranging evaluation of what really happened. Well, we're going to try and defend the original Durban Declaration and Plan of Action. Try to present it in circles where maybe people who post 2001 haven't had information about it or are disinformed by the dominant media way of speaking about Durban, which is always pointing to declarations of a couple of NGOs and then forgetting the main issue. And then we'll just go on working. What we do, I work in education. We're trying to guarantee access to education, overcoming discrimination in terms of access to education, and guaranteeing that the education that people receive is non-discriminatory also. So that'll be our continued work.
The outcome of the conference, from our perspective, I think is very good. As you know, there was an attempt to derail the conference. There was many attempts to ensure that key wording in the Durban 2001 program of action was taken away, or taken out of the revision. The fact that we have retained that, I think that is significant. The Durban World Conference Against Racism, with the language declaring that the transatlantic slave trade, slavery, and colonialism was a crime against humanity, that stands, and that's what is important for us. What we have noted is that the countries or the families, all of those people who have benefited from slavery, the slave trade and so on, and colonialism, they are not going to abide by the 2001 agreement that they themselves signed. There's no way those people are taking that language or the outcome of that conference seriously with respect to reparation. It therefore means that we have to develop a strategy. Our strategy will have to be a lot more aggressive. And at the moment, we are giving a lot of thought about how we are going to move on the legal front. I do not think we have any choice but having to lobby Caribbean, for example, the Caribbean African government, to ensure that they enact the necessary legislative amendment to their constitution or whatever policy they want to initiate that will give NGOs like ourselves and the folks who are interested in reparation the opportunity to pursue the legal options. I don't think we have any other choice. And having said that, I also think another piece of work that we have to do, reparation activists have to do, is to educate our people more on the importance of the Durban Declaration of Program of Action, to make sure that more of our people understand the significance of the Durban Declaration and Program of Action and understand comprehensively what reparation is. Unfortunately, too many people think that reparation is just a check. It is not. It's much broader than that. It's about development. It's about technology transfer. It's about a new international arrangement, whether it's access to trade, trading relationship, how the World Banks operate. It's a gamut of other issues.
So, on the one hand, I mean, and talking specifically about this conference, it has been a success that we, as a movement, had been able to maintain this alive against the odds. I mean, keep in mind that the Durban Declaration and Plan of Action was approved right before 9/11 of 2001 in a very hostile context already, because the U.S. walked out of the conference in Durban, South Africa, and we have been fighting against very powerful enemies of this process, and we have been able to keep the process alive, and that has some real meaning. Unfortunately, the Obama administration followed the same kind of arguments of the Bush administration, saying that they were not coming here because of the Israeli denouncement of Zionism as a form of racism, and because of the reparations. I mean, I disagree with that kind of argumentation, but even if you would agree with it, that should not be enough reason not to come here, not to dialogue, and not to be part of the process. Now, indeed, Latin America has been the only region of the world in which, in a very real way, this has translated into a vehicle of empowerment for people of African descent. It's being like a banner, a set of principles that to a large extent has defined our agenda, even though it's not, we're not following it as a UN agenda, but as an instrument for struggle, for organizing, for education, for opening space against racism in the Americas.
I'd like to emphasize that even though it's true that in Latin America is the region where the Durban Plan of Action actually was very progressive and there has been a lot of advances, I would like to say that right now there is a backlash in Latin America, and the level of the denial of the existence of racial discrimination, it's unbelievable. And I think the visit that the UN Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism and the UN Independent Expert did to the Dominican Republic last year proved that. But that's not only the problem in the Dominican Republic. It's a problem all over Latin America, with few exceptions. I mean, there is a huge denial of the existence of racial discrimination. And another thing I would like to point out in terms of challenges is that, yes, it's true, the governments have been created offices or national institutions to combat racial discrimination. Those institutions have little money. The budget is very limited, so what they can do is very limited. And so we have to think, okay, we want offices just to have an office, or do we really want an office that can do something about it? And this is a big challenge also in the Americas. And finally, the situation of Afro-Latinos in the United States. This is something that nobody has been talking about. And there's an increased number of Afro-Latinos in the United States right now, and they are really invisible.
Indigenous people who have been following the Durban process, these are the people who are sort of continue to work on it. But it's not enough, because most of the time we don't have really the means in order to be able to reach out much further. For example, if an indigenous organization, an Afro-descendant organization worked on it, they don't really have the means to go in every community and in every province, to go with it. And unfortunately also the nation states, the governments, they have just maybe an office, sometimes not even an office, just a person who is in charge to work on these topics. And then they don't really do national campaigns to promote it how it normally should be. For example, when we worked on the conference on women, Beijing, after that there was a much more important effort was done by governments and by organizations to really mainstream it all over the place. And the result was that laws have changed at national level, and things were implemented. But with the racism, there is not that will, and there is not that, and there is no funding for it also. Well, I think we have to promote a lot still the DDPA, which came out in 2001. We have to be clear that this is just one step further, and there is a lot more steps we have to do. I think each one of us has to try to, even with no means, try to do our best to mainstream it now. And we have to work with our governments at home in order that they implement amendments in the legal system or whatever they have to do in order that this racial discrimination can be eradicated. But we know that a lot of nation states, they really don't want to go for it, so we will have to continue to push and push and push and push, and I don't know how long.
Underlying all human rights work in the United States is a commitment to challenge a belief that the United States is inherently superior to other countries of the world, and that neither the U.S. government nor the U.S. rights movement have anything to gain from the domestic application of human rights. Network members believe that the U.S. government should no longer be allowed to shield itself from accountability to human rights norms, and that the U.S. civil, disability, women's, workers, immigrant, LGBTQ, prisoner impunity, and other rights movements that stand to benefit perhaps now more than ever from an end to U.S. impunity in this regard. For more information on how to join the U.S. Human Rights Network, visit us online at www.ushrnetwork.org. Human Rights No Retreat, No Compromise podcast is a production of the U.S. Human Rights Network.
In its wake, Katrina left a ravaged Gulf Coast and a nation shocked by the images of poverty and neglect that it revealed.
To the extent that the federal government didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility. It was